Hi there, welcome to We Need to Talk, a podcast that helps empower each of us. And I'm the host, Jane Hasler, a sociologist, mental health professional, and mother of eight, seven sons and one daughter, who range in age from 16 up to 33 years. Each episode, I'm talking with an expert on a particular social issue, from mental health to climate change, from pornography to bullying. Knowledge is power, so let's get started. This episode, I'm talking with world-renowned forensic psychologist Professor James Ogloff about our punitive prison system, the causes of criminal behaviour, and how we can lower our high recidivism rate. For over 20 years, Professor Ogloff was a director at ForensiCare, Victoria's leading provider of forensic mental health services. He has published 18 books, over 350 academic articles, and has just taken up his new role as the Dean of Health Sciences at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne. Jim talks about the toxic and highly masculine environments in our prison system, which fuel violent behaviour. He explains why it's vital to provide the right support to offenders during and after their incarceration, which is focused on rehabilitation and reintegration. This compassionate approach is not just for the well-being of individuals who offend, but for the well-being of our society as a whole. So sit back for a truly insightful and fascinating discussion with Professor James Ogloff. Okay, so welcome to Professor James Ogloff, and thank you so much, Jim, for being on We Need to Talk and discussing such a vital issue as reoffending in Australia and what we need to do about it. I just guess I'd like to start with a question as a sociologist myself and speaking to a lot of other people in this area. I see many of our prisons in Australia as violence factories. Can you understand why we might be saying that, why we look at them as violence factories?
Yeah, I certainly do understand that. It's putting people together in very unusual environments really engenders further violence and lots of problem behavior. There's no question about that.
Yes, absolutely. You've done so much research over the years. What do you think are the risk factors? Well, not think, you know. What are the risk factors in relation to recidivism or reoffending? Some people call it recidivism. Some people say reoffending. In Australia, what are the risk factors?
There are lots of different risk factors. And of course, at some level, there are sort of three elements. One is the individual risk factors. Two is the sort of broader environment or societal risk factors, and three are the contextual risk factors. So the individual risk factors are the factors that really affect the individual, and it's focusing on their attitudes usually. So what happens is over time, people who do crime develop attitudes that support that. So we call it criminal thinking. So most of us are raised, you know, from an early age to be pro-social, not to break the law, to follow the rules. And therefore, if we do start breaking rules, we have to essentially trick ourselves into doing that. That is, begin to believe either the rules are wrong or we're somehow special. So what happens over time is people's thinking begins to change and they begin to see the violation of rules as okay, at least under some circumstances for them. So the individual factors then, the attitudes and criminal thinking are very, very important. Generally, we can't behave in ways that are inconsistent with our attitudes. That makes us uncomfortable and we wouldn't continue. The second factor that's very related to that, of course, is our behavior. So the thoughts are one thing. So you could have criminal thoughts or antisocial thoughts, but maybe never engage in that behavior. So probably lots of us have thought about that, say when we're driving. We might become angry, we think, gee, I should bash the car in front of me or something like that. But most of us don't do that. So in addition to these criminal thoughts or attitudes, you also have the development of antisocial behavior. So it's taking that step towards behaving in a way that's untoward. So they tend to be the two of the three of the individual factors. The final one is around the person's personality. So as we know, everybody has a different personality. It really defines to a large extent who we are. And personalities can be more consistent with offending. And they might be, for example, a hostile personality. So somebody who looks at the world as a hostile, difficult place, almost like a dog-eat-dog world, and they might feel they have to get someone before someone gets them. And also could be personalities around being very selfish or having very little regard for other people. So those attitudes, behavior, and personality are the individual characteristics. And then if we think about our environment or social context, they really hinge on our friends, our friendships. And what happens, of course, is mostly our friends share our values and attitudes. So for people who do crime, over time, they often develop friendships or acquaintances with people who share those criminal thoughts with them, who see the violation of law as acceptable and sometimes even beneficial. So the associates or peers or mates, they're really a very essential part. And it's often very hard for people to move away from committing crime because you have to give up your friendships. And in addition to friendships, you also have the family, a person's family. And depending on their stage in life, it could be if they're a young person, it could be their immediate family, their mom and dad, their siblings. If they're older, it could be their own family, so their partner and so forth. So the more that there are difficulties with family within the family unit, or in some cases where family members are also offending or antisocial, that can be problematic. So they're generally seen as the environmental factors. And then you have the context in which we live. And those will be things like our employment and education opportunities. So oftentimes people who offend, they sometimes, but not always, start younger in life. So they might have difficulties with education or employment. They might also have difficulties or limitations in formal activities with other people, the leisure activities or recreational activities. And then, of course, one of the factors that cuts across a few of these areas is substance abuse, which is such a significant part of offending. And that's the abuse of illegal drugs, the abuse of alcohol, and sometimes the abuse of prescription medication. So substance abuse is one that cuts a bit across because often it's driven by the individual's attitudes, but it's often something we share with our associates or friends if we're using drugs or alcohol. And then also it's often part of our broader community. So although a long-winded answer, those are the factors, many of the factors we think that do influence whether someone will offend. And so you can see, Jane, that it's very complex, and to help people stop crime, you need to be able to identify what are the factors that drive them to commit crime, and then how will they adapt, and how can we support them developing protective factors to begin to reduce the likelihood of offending.
Because there is certainly a big correlation between illicit drug use and as you said, alcohol use and criminal behaviour. And just going back to what you said about how influential the social network is that we have, my dear mum used to say, you can actually tell a lot about a person by the company they keep. But a lot of the time people keep this company for this sense of belonging and acceptance, which is so important to identity. But yeah, I attended a panel recently on should we decriminalize illicit drug use? And because we have such a punitive approach, really, don't we, Jim, to both drug use and also criminal behavior. A friend of one of our children who very tragically died from an overdose, and our daughter was trying to help him. He'd been in jail for 6 months, and he said, if you're not addicted when you go in, you'll become addicted to drugs when you're in there. Do you think there's a real problem with this issue? You know, yeah. We have such a punitive approach. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's a few issues. First of all, you're right that there's a relationship between substance misuse and offending. I mean, we've looked at this in some detail with young offenders, and a few years ago, we actually did a pretty sophisticated study and found that about 3/4 of offending by young people is either driven directly by substance abuse, or it's done to get resources to get drugs or alcohol. So there is a strong relationship. And unfortunately, like we mentioned a bit earlier, the environment of prisons is one that, you know, there's some availability of drugs and sometimes homemade alcohol, but also just the environment is very anxiety arousing. It's a very difficult environment. I think in Australia in particular, we think through the media that prisons are somehow country clubs or not that bad. But anybody who spent time in a prison will tell you that's just not true. They're very difficult environments for the people who live there and the people who work there for that matter.
Mm. So particularly when we're looking at the prison system in Australia, we have a relatively high recidivism rate, don't we, Jim, in relation to other countries. It does vary from state to state, but it is on average around 60% recidivism reoffending rate. Is that right?
Yeah, it's very difficult, Jane, to measure this because even within Australia, we measure it differently across jurisdictions. So if we just unpack that for a minute, if you start at the broadest level, it's really reoffending. And obviously not all offenders get caught. So the starting point is are people reoffending? So that's the first level. The second is if they are rearrested or charged, then it's the next level is are they convicted? And then the next level might be are they reincarcerated or re-imprisoned? And so if you we won't go through all of those, but generally speaking, the recidivism rate, if you look at reoffending, is high and generally accepted to be probably 60% over 2 to 4 years. Reincarceration is lower. That's usually closer to 40% and sometimes even a bit lower over time. But yes, it is quite high. It's very difficult to measure it across countries because, again, the data aren't always available and countries measure things very differently. And even what is offending. So, for example, if you can believe the academics, we get into debates whether things like fines should be considered an offense if you had a crime for which you received a fine or whether it should be limited to a corrections order or incarceration. But if we look at the developed countries, the OECD, we do find that Australia, along with some other like countries, have relatively high rates of reoffending. So the countries that have higher rates of reoffending tend to be Australia, New Zealand, the United States tend to be higher rates of reoffending. Middle of the road sort of countries would be most of the European countries, and Canada finds itself in that group. And then if you look at Scandinavian countries and sometimes some of the Asian countries such as Japan, South Korea, Singapore have actually lower rates of reoffending. So there are differences, as you mentioned, within Australia, but even when we look at Australia and other countries.
Mm. I have to bring up, Jim, Norway with its low recidivism rate of around 20%. I may be wrong there, but it's considered a best practice incarceration system. Around 20 years ago, they looked at their jail system and said, we have to take a far less punitive approach. Is that something that we could be drawing from here in Australia? Because now it showed that it was very effective.
Yeah. I think this is really difficult for people in the community to understand. And anytime I talk to people about this, they think I've lost it, because there is a very close relationship, believe it or not, between how punitive a country is and the rates of reoffending. So if you look at so-called developed countries, probably the United States would be seen as the most punitive. So they have typically higher sentencing rates, higher incarceration rates, but they also have very high reoffense rates. And so there's this terrible cycle that develops where the more punitive you are in society, ironically, the more people you begin to incarcerate and the higher the incarceration rate is, but also the higher the reoffense rate is. Whereas countries that are less punitive, and you use Norway, and Norway is often used as an example because, for example, with the terrible case of Anders Breivik, who people will know killed a number of people, I forget how many, but in the vicinity of 70 people, and received a 21-year sentence for that. Whereas in Australia, a 21-year sentence would be seen as very, very light, even for drunk driving causing death, for example. So there is a, I think in society, and I probably shared this view early in my life, is, you know, if we want to reduce crime, we need to really be more punitive and teach people a lesson. But, you know, at least now for 120 years around the world, we've learned that that simply doesn't work. It may be mainly common sense, but it's wrong, that in fact, societies that are less punitive, that actually try to address some of the underlying factors that precipitate offending, and then once people are in systems, deal with them in a way that tries to really change their behavior rather than reinforce their behavior, they're more successful. And so Norway is held out as an example because many people don't know, but Norway is not, certainly not as multicultural as Australia, but Norway does have an indigenous population, and the indigenous people, the Sami people, are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And like you said, about 20 years ago, specific efforts were undertaken to reform the prison system. And that's actually been quite successful. So for us, we're sadly in Australia going in the opposite direction at the moment. I'm a Canadian originally. I came here in 2001, at which time our reincarceration rate, particularly say in Victoria where I live, was lower than it was in many countries. And now we're actually much higher. So we've gotten tougher on crime. We've built more prisons. We've put more people in prison, but our incarceration rate really remains either unchanged or increasing.
Well, we really do need to do something there, don't we, Jim? I wanted to mention the famous writer, Clive James. You've probably heard of him. And he said famously that the problem with Australians isn't so much that they descend from convicts, it's that they descend from prison officers. And I think there's a lot of truth in what he said. And then Clive, of course, spent a lot of his time overseas. But why do you think this punitive approach exists? Do you think it stems a lot from the European settlement, colonialism? Do you think we need to sit back and say, where is this coming from? We need to take a different approach?
Yeah, I think it's probably even simpler than that, Jane. I think it's probably human nature. And if we just think about, I know you're a mom, I'm a dad, I've grown children. And, you know, I've often thought, having worked for 40 years with offenders, including sometimes very notorious and violent offenders, you know, and I'm someone who's obviously works in the justice system and has strong moral sense, but I have a good understanding of why people offend. And I think the problem in society is there is this vengeance vindictiveness. And again, as a dad, I would have that. So if one of my children were harmed by somebody, I would want to be vindicated. But the difficulty is, as a society, we have to think very differently. We have to think what's best for society over the long term, not what vengeance can we dole out in a particular circumstance. So we almost always hear every night on the news, or every time we look at the news on our devices, that there's a sentence that somehow the public don't think it's you know, strong enough. They're not going to prison for a long enough period of time. And I think the belief is, again, comes from this sense of vengeance, but at the same time, because most of us are law-abiding people, we think that if we were punished, we wouldn't offend. But that's just really an asinine belief. So if I can give you an example, early in my life, I lived in the United States, and I was quite involved in people who are on death row. And in fact, the first academic paper I ever wrote was about adolescents and children on death row in the United States. And so what happened, you know, for a period of time, the United States stopped the death penalty for about 4 years, and then states restarted the death penalty in the mid-70s. But some states did, some states didn't. So a lot of people did the research and looked at, you know, are states, or do states that have the death penalty, do they have lower rates of murder than states that don't? And of course, they found no difference. In fact, now it's almost the opposite. Some states that retain the death penalty have higher rates of homicide. And if you think about it from the offender's perspective, just for a second, then it could be murder, it could be any crime. When we think about deterrence doesn't really work, because most people, when they're going to offend, it assumes that they're rational, that they're able to control their impulses, and that they're thinking about the potential punishment that they might get. So, for example, if I'm in a state in the United States that has the death penalty versus one that doesn't. So if I'm in a state that doesn't have the death penalty, I'm not going to think, well, if I kill Jane, then I won't get the death penalty. So I'll go ahead and do it because I'll just spend my life in prison. Versus, oh no, I'm in a state that has the death penalty, so I won't kill Jane because I'll be executed. And if we move that to more simple behaviors, such as I'll steal this or I'll rob this person, usually we don't think we'll be caught. And the punishment is sort of far from our thinking. So unfortunately, just like when we're raising children, punishment doesn't really work very well. We know that more punitive parents often produce children who become more violent and punitive themselves. So I think there's this human nature towards vengeance, which as a society, we need to fight against. And we've done a good job generally in Australia, like we think about the death penalty. You know, no one's been executed since the 60s. And generally speaking, although occasionally people wish we had a death penalty, I think most people realize this isn't something that really has much utility. But if we look at other areas, and these days it's not the death penalty, it's incarceration. Like having worked in prisons my whole life, sentences of 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, that's a long time. But when we hear it on the news, it doesn't seem like a long time. So I think that's where we're different. Countries, again, like Norway, like Sweden, but Scandinavian countries, they typically have lower sentences and different expectations of what incarceration means.
Because they don't, from what I've read, Jim, they don't look so much at the people who are working there as prison officers. They look at them as peers or people that have been through being incarcerated and who can relate to the people who are in there. So their focus is on rehabilitation or even not even rehabilitation. A lot of them haven't learnt the way to be in a civilized society. So it's actually really focusing on giving them a second, third chance, isn't it? Would you say that?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, if you think about the purpose of prisons are really for losing your liberty. That's the purpose. And again, I think some people now realize this from COVID. In Victoria, you know, we had the worst experiences, I think, where we could only be out for an hour, 2 hours a day. We weren't allowed to go to playgrounds. You were allowed to go to the shops, typically one person at a time. And I have many friends who really had difficulty with that environment. So just losing one's liberty is actually very difficult. But I think when we think of prison, we have views that the purpose of prison is more around punishment, when the punishment really is the restriction of liberty. The purpose really is rehabilitation. And I think most people would like prisons to be environments that change people for the better. But sadly, that doesn't happen for all people. What I've found is people who change for the better, and they do, I think we shouldn't underestimate, like we said, upwards of 40% of people don't reoffend. That's actually quite remarkable. But it's usually because of what I said earlier, attitudes. They change their attitudes. They just decide, I'm not going to do this anymore. And that's got to be the driver. But so one of the things, you know, we need to begin to do, and it's just a very big task, is really begin to change the way prisons operate, but also rethink, why are we putting people in prison? Some countries like Canada, in their sentencing provisions, they typically sentence for utilitarian reasons. So what that means is people are imprisoned if they're going to be a risk to the public. If you're not going to be a risk to the public, then there are other forms of punishment that would be more suitable. Whereas in some of our states, for example, West Australia, which has a very high Indigenous population, a surprisingly large number of prisoners, many of whom are Indigenous, are there for nonviolent offending and even sometimes unpaid fines. You know, so this doesn't make sense. So it's first of all rethinking who gets incarcerated, but very importantly, what a prison is like and what the purpose is. And I think you mentioned the role of the people that work there, and the role of people who work in prison should be change agents and not so much guards. And contemporary prison services have tried to make those changes, but it's very difficult. partly because of the volume of people we have coming in, and also the historical mindset of both prisoners and prison officers. And therefore, it's a very difficult thing to change.
Of course, just there, Jim, I want to mention, as a sociologist, I've done a lot of research on the relationship between gender expectations around masculinity and violence. And it's been shown to be a highly masculine, as in tough, dog-eat-dog environment in our prison system, not just from the inmates' perspective, but from those working there. So we need to, would you say, address that environment to make it a more compassionate, a kinder environment. Can I just mention there, when I was at the previous criminal justice conference, I spoke to a fellow who'd been in jail, an inmate for 5 years, white collar crime. And he said, look, he started to give talks to a lot of the men in there. And he said, a lot of them are really little boys, many of them, who have never been given the care or love that they have been craving. Would you say there's some truth in that, and we need to have a different approach within our prison system?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've asked a few sort of different questions together, but I think the starting point is that, you know, I think within men's prisons, they're terribly masculinized. Now, over my lifetime, that hasn't actually improved much. It's interesting that I'm old enough that when I began to work in prisons, a lot of prison officers were soldiers. So people who returned from even the Second World War, but the Korean War in Canada, and ended up working in sort of paramilitary organizations like prisons. And so prison staff are very much, there's a hierarchy, there's a rank, there's uniforms. Now that's of course changed a little bit now, but still it's very much the guard and the prisoner. And again, early in my career, you wouldn't use somebody's name. So that was the first thing. You would never call a prisoner by their first name. You might call them by their surname. And the prison officer similar would be called Mr. So-and-so. And so you already change the dynamics about that. So the culture itself is very toxic. I think there's no question. And a lot of my work more recently has been looking at the well-being of prison officers. And they really suffer from that culture as well. I've seen in my career, you know, a number of prison officers commit suicide, have, some of our research showed, high levels of dysfunction in their own life. So this toxic environment affects all people who are there, staff and prison officers alike. Now, interestingly, just as an aside, people might be surprised to learn that women's prisons are often even more difficult than men's prisons. And part of the reason is because, as you've sort of intimated, a lot of people who come to prison have significant problems. Now, it's never an excuse. And I think that's something the public doesn't want to know is, you know, you've had a bad childhood, so you've offended. And generally, in my experience, that's not an explanation, because the vast majority of people who've had a difficult life don't go on to offend. But what we see is people in prisons have high rates of mental and cognitive incapacity or disability, substance abuse we've already touched on, as you've already mentioned, often very difficult upbringings, childhood, I've mentioned family, limited education opportunities, and so forth. Now, within women's prisons, so in the society, we know that for every one woman who's in prison, we have about 11 men. So it's very rare for women to go to prison. And as a result, the women's prisons tend to have a higher percentage of women who have these problems. And so we do have these terribly difficult environments, both in women's prisons and men's prisons, which really need to begin to change. But you can see that it's a complex problem, and it's really, you need to begin to make systematic changes across the system, not just at any point in the system. And in Australia, as long as I've been in Australia for 20 plus years, I've been in prisons in every state and worked in every state and territory. And a lot of prisons, to their benefit, have tried to make significant changes. But and by that often I mean rehabilitation programs, education programs, lots of very good both professional and non-governmental organizations involvement. But it's been so difficult because the culture itself doesn't really change. And that's what we need to really focus on is not just the things we do in prison, but the culture itself and how we design prisons, how we manage prisons, how we employ people to work in prisons, and how we work with the people who come and live in the prison.
Yes. One of the presentations I attended there at the conference 3 years ago, they spoke about we need to be focusing on discharge of the inmate from the time they first are incarcerated. And we have a big problem, don't we? When people leave prison, they're not supported enough, particularly with accommodation. What are your comments about that, Jim?
So that's exactly right. I mean, a proper way to run a prison, and some of our prisons try to do this, is as soon as somebody is actually admitted to prison, they'll do an evaluation to identify what are the factors that brought them in. Have they been in prison before? And essentially develop a plan. So it's just like if someone comes to hospital, you know, from day one, there's an assessment. What has happened to the person? What needs to happen to actually ensure the person can leave the hospital and not come back to the hospital? And in prison, we need to do the same thing because, as I've mentioned right at the outset, the drivers for offending will differ from person to person, although there's some similarities. So we need to start with that. And then one thing we don't do well in Australia, which contributes to high offending, is often people will be in prison even for long periods of time, and then they essentially are released to the community, sometimes on parole and sometimes not. And again, one thing we've done in Australia is we've gotten tougher on who gets parole. And again, from society, it might make sense. Well, you know, they have a sentence. Why don't they serve the sentence? But I tell you, as a citizen, I'd much rather have somebody who's been in prison for any period of time on parole, where they have conditions and oftentimes accommodation and support, than someone who leaves a prison, is in a prison one day and leaves the prison the next day to their own devices. So some countries use a system of halfway houses and graduated release programs from prison. Those are very, very beneficial and can be very helpful. So you're exactly right. It's release, and accommodation is a significant problem. In my experience, it's even worse for women, because most men do have often a woman in their life, either a partner, a mom, a sister, who they can rely on. But when a woman's incarcerated, often they're very estranged from everybody. So accommodation's a very important part of that element. So what I'd like to see is a graduated release system where you start with supervised visits away from the prison. So for example, go and set up a bank account, set up Centrelink, make contacts with whatever agencies you'll need to work with while you're escorted. If a person's safe enough, have unescorted leave. And then basically when people are released, release them to a halfway house. And what that means is a place where they have a curfew, but during the day, they're meant to be getting work, getting education, attending programs, and being supervised, so that once they're left to their own devices, they're able to survive. I often see young men and women leaving prisons with nothing, no money, no supports. And even if we think about things like mental illness, in most of our states, services are doled out based on where you live. And so a high percentage of prisoners won't have an address. So it's difficult to link them to services because they're usually geographically organized. So we're often setting people up for failure in the release back to community.
Wow, there needs to be a lot of work there, doesn't there, Jim? To particularly on discharge, to support people. And as you were saying, escorted to go out and set up so many things so that they're prepared before they leave. Also education and also employment. That can start whilst they're incarcerated. Focus on that, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a big part of rehabilitation, is really, like when I mentioned these factors at the beginning, attitudes, associates, antisocial behavior, family, employment, education, substance abuse, leisure, recreation. We need to address all those things in prison. And so employment and education are very important, and it's meaningful education and employment. So it's really skills-based. So some of the best things I've seen are in Victoria. We do have a very unique system in Australia where young adults can be sentenced to a period of youth detention, even though they're 18 or older when they offend, 18 to 21 under some circumstances. And it's actually quite interesting because they can develop real skills. So I have, in fact, an acquaintance who went, you know, became a carpenter and actually now works teaching young men and boys carpentry skills in a TAFE program at a youth justice center for older boys. And that's a wonderful skill. So you leave prison, and as you mentioned earlier, oftentimes a person will have poor experience, they'll have had no employment opportunities. And now if they can leave with, say, capacity to finish an apprenticeship in a trade, it's a real benefit. And so it's meaningful activities around that. And also getting a spark in their life around recreation and leisure. It's not surprising that prisoners also have very poor health generally. And because they're people from society who very often have had been disenfranchised from services. Sometimes we've talked about substance abusing and so forth. And therefore we can also assist them in health and leisure and recreation so that they can feel fulfilled. They can develop positive relationships when they leave.
You probably read about Tim Robbins, the star of The Shawshank Redemption. He's been running drama workshops for the last 20 years in the prison system over in America. I couldn't think of a better person running them starring in one of the most popular films around incarceration.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So it's really, it's really addressing the things we think about, like, mental illness, substance abuse, but also attitudes. People need to feel better about themselves. I mean, one thing that might be a surprise to listeners is that most offenders really struggle with, when I was very young working in a prison, it surprised me that these people I dealt with were often very street smart, but they would struggle with everyday tasks because they weren't really socialized to do that. So developing their basic skills and abilities to navigate the world.
Absolutely. Just two final things I just wanted to mention there, Jim. The incarceration of our Indigenous community. Whilst they make up only 3% of our population, they do make up, from my understanding, at least around 30% of our prison population. Is that correct?
That's right. It depends on which jurisdiction, but, even Victoria, which has the smallest Indigenous population of about 0.7%, it's at least 10 to 15 times. And when we go to states like WA or territories like Northern Territory, it's the majority. And this is very sad for me as a Canadian, because I'm now an Australian, but we are probably 20 or 25 years behind countries like Canada, where, all countries that have colonized have an overrepresentation of Indigenous people. That's very common. I mentioned Norway, but it's the same with New Zealand, United States, Canada. But we have not addressed these problems. And the Canadians, thanks to a Supreme Court or High Court case there many years, when Indigenous people are sentenced, special considerations given, and incarceration is really a last resort. Where here we just feel like we need to lock people up, irrespective of their background, when the focus should be again on utilitarian elements. Now, one of the things we're doing a bit better, is reuniting Indigenous people with their heritage. So I did some work in Victoria several years ago. We were employed by the Departments of Health and Justice to look at the well-being of Indigenous people. So we actually went into prisons and we assessed every prisoner, man and woman. And we did it with a team that included a mental health professional and an Indigenous social services worker. So we would have cultural safety, and we looked at mental health, cognitive disability, and we also looked at social and emotional well-being from an Aboriginal lens. And what we found is terribly high rates of difficulties in those areas. And for a lot of Indigenous people, they were separated from their own culture, their heritage. And so efforts to begin to develop a positive identity about one's background is quite important. And lots of people would have obviously experienced racism when they're young and discrimination. And to be able to begin to embrace their culture and feel a connectedness, I think that is important. So, we can't overstate the importance of addressing issues around overrepresentation of Indigenous people in the criminal justice system and how we can ameliorate that situation.
Yeah, particularly from that cultural perspective. I was in tears going back a couple of years ago. Two teenagers, I think 15, 16, who were Indigenous, were being chased by police in Western Australia, and they jumped into a raging river not knowing how to swim, and they died. And it was almost like, well, we'd rather risk our lives than end up in our justice system.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Several years ago, a colleague and I, we did a review of the youth justice system in Victoria, and we met with many, many young people in the youth justice system. And I remember a young man from Africa said when he moved to Australia, it was the first place he lived in a city that was developed. And he'd lived in asylum seeker camps in different countries. And he said at the beginning, police cars and taxis looked the same to him, because they had, you know, they had sort of things on the roof and he couldn't read. And he said he started to realize police car stop for you, but the taxis won't. So if you're an African young man, he said, you know, police were always stopping him, but he could never get a taxi.
Yes.
So I think that's right. We do have, you know, we do have these issues are very, very difficult.
Yes, around stereotyping and all of that, absolutely. And finally, I just wanted to ask you about the privatising of our jail system. We see a lot of that, of course, in America. I think it's mostly privatised. Is there a danger in it happening here, mostly in Australia? And how can we best support certain standards in Australia within our jail system?
Yeah, it's a very difficult matter. I mean, in Victoria, we do have a blend. We have some, you know, most of our prisons are public and some are private. And when I came, that was a surprise to me. Now, one of the prisons that was private became public, which was the women's prison. But we have one longstanding private prison and a newer private prison. And they actually run remarkably well. And I think partly it's because of the, not that they're private or public, but it's how they're managed, and of course the contract with government. So, you know, personally, I probably wouldn't want to see private prisons, but they can be managed accordingly if they have, you know, very high standards. And so in our state, part of my work is with the state Forensic Mental Health Service, which is the public health service that's responsible for mental health service delivery in prisons. And we actually run a large mental health service in a private prison that actually runs really well. So I don't think it's necessarily private prison or not. I think it's more the standards and culture within the prisons.
Which is overseen by the state and federal government's accreditation processes, would you say?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. We've covered a lot, haven't we?
We have. I just wanted to sort of make a plug. You mentioned this conference a couple of times, the International Criminal Justice Conference. So we are holding the 10th International Criminal Justice Conference later this year.
Yes, I am aware. Yeah.
This will be held in Melbourne in November, around November 22nd. And people can find out about that on the website, just looking up it'll be the 10th International Criminal Justice Conference. And we're looking at building safer and resilient communities under global uncertainty. So we'll try to address some of these issues. I think the final thing I wanted to say is that, you know, having worked in prisons and for so many years, my job is to make society safer. And I really think that's very important. And I've done that as much as I could by helping to help rehabilitate people who are offending. And as a psychologist, it's a win-win, because obviously, from a societal perspective, it's a terrible thing when somebody offends or reoffends, and we can have, obviously, victims from that. But it's also bad for the person themselves. And if we can rehabilitate any prisoner, we're not only protecting the community, but we're assisting them. And I think as a society, a developed society, that's what we want to see. We want to see how we can assist people in their recovery towards non-offending in a way that protects society and benefits them. So it's not one or the other, you know, be punitive or rehabilitate. It's really very much combined. So part of my work is sadly identifying people who aren't ready for release or who are not, for whatever reason, able to rehabilitate or haven't changed. And that's important. But it's as important to identify people who can change and assist them in doing that to help make society a safer place.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to finish our discussion. It's been fantastic and so insightful, Jim. I thank you so much for your time. And look, I'll be there at the conference, so I'll see you there.
Thanks very much for the time. Thank you.
Oh, no, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Jim. Next episode, I'm talking with author and activist Thomas Mayer, who carried the Uluru Statement from the Heart around Australia for 18 months to gain further support after it was rejected in 2017 by the Turnbull government. Thomas talks about the three key elements of the Uluru Statement: voice, treaty, and truth. In particular, why our country needs an enshrined Indigenous voice to Parliament. Our discussion helps to dispel the confusion around what effect this change to our constitution will have, and makes clear why this action is vital to the well-being of our nation. Until then, take good care of yourselves and each other, and remember, knowledge is power.